Welcome to We Dig Metal Evolution, a special Let It Roll maxi-series discussing Sam Dunn's Metal Evolution documentary series, hosted by Nate Wilcox with Eugene S. Robinson of the art punk band Oxbow and entertainment lawyer Alexi Auld. Let It Roll is the insanely ambitious musical history podcast. We've covered the early history of rock and roll, country music in the 20th century, the rise of hip-hop, disco, and electronic dance music, and now heavy metal. Stay tuned for our histories of Broadway, opera, punk rock, jazz, blues, and gospel. Follow the Let It Roll podcast on Twitter at Let It Rollcast, and check out our website at letitrollpodcast.com. Let It Roll is a Pantheon podcast, and you can listen to more great podcasts at www.pantheonpodcasts.com. Today, Nate, Eugene, and Alexi discuss nu metal, the controversial mix of metal and hip-hop that gained immense popularity in the late 1990s and early 2000s. Email us at letitrollpodcast@gmail.com. Pop in those earbuds and enjoy.
It's time to Let It Roll. I'm your host, Nate Wilcox, and we're back again with Alexi Auld and Eugene S. Robinson to continue our discussion of Sam Dunn's Metal Evolution series that aired on VH1 a few years back. The eighth episode is called New Metal and covers the number of funk and hip-hop influenced metal bands that emerged first out of the late 80s alternative metal scene and later became a full-blown subgenre in the 1990s and became painfully, enormously successful, but we'll get to that in a minute. Does somebody want to get something off their chest? Do we want to share our old man generational hate of nu metal?
I can't say old man because I'm younger than Fred Durst, and a lot of the people in those groups are in my age range. Yeah. So it's not an age dynamic at all. I think it could be a place in your life kind of dynamic, because when all that stuff was hitting, I was in New York. I was around very good-looking, well-to-do women of all different walks of life.
When he was 21.
And I was, going to the clubs. So listening to music about breaking stuff and being frustrated at the world and mad at things, I just couldn't relate.
Yeah, you're old. I mean, I was in the same boat. I did not.
25. I was 25 years old. Yes, I was.
I know, but this stuff was for 15-year-olds.
Fred Durst was 27. 28.
I don't care. That's not who it was for. I mean, Mick Jagger was the same age as Ed Ward, but Jimmy Page was the same age as Ed Ward. Ed Ward was too old to listen to Led Zeppelin until 2017. It's just a recurring thing. I've been talking to guys in their 30s, 20s. They seem to like this stuff. It seems like it's held up. And even like Korn at the time, I think was pretty critically respected. I knew my nephew and different people that I respected.
Your nephew liked him.
My nephew said good musical taste.
Your nephew, the critic.
Critics. I mean, right. That's the thing. Like, there's nothing more useless than musical criticism. Like, I used to be a big believer. Oh, there's objective great art and blah blah blah, and it will out. And I do think that some things are better than others, and the way you see it is that more people like them over time, and they also have influence on later generations of musicians. But
Simon Reynolds.
He's an excellent writer, but he gets stuff wrong all the time.
It is a matter of taste. It's all a matter of
taste and perspective and where you are in life experience.
Yes, but just taste. I think taste, because I think taste incorporates perspective and where you are in life. It's just taste. And it was just not of my taste or like it.
I hated this stuff at the time, but...
I'm watching this thing last night, and I'm watching, and I'm going to watch it. And I'm like this the whole time. Until they started talking about Woodstock 99, and bit by bit it started to be, it was like a Charlie Brown Christmas, or maybe the Grinch. You see smiles starting to appear on my face, and then I start to chuckle a bit, and by the time they showed shit burning down and just rioters and people, at that point I was laughing like I've never laughed before. That was a high point of the story as far as I'm concerned.
It's like the old man when the kid's ball gets knocked over the fence under the train.
those kids will never play stickball again.
Remember Rushmore when Bill Murray was on the phone with the guy and he was like, yeah, yeah, hold on for a second. And he ran on the court and like stuffed the basketball from some little kid. He's like, now what you saying again?
Pretty much.
Exactly. Just ran out like, pow, hold on for a second.
Yeah, I know. Listen,
at one point, I'm working at Code Magazine at the time, so this is like 98, 99, and I get a PR package from Columbia Records, and it's two bands, Cypress Hill and this band called Rage Against the Machine, and I was distinctly, and this was the same kind of couple year period, I think I'd gotten, you know, maybe a few years from the same PR person that sent me Pearl Jam, and I wish I had the first record I liked, tell you. And I listened to Rage Against the Machine. The first words out of my mouth were, one of these guys going to send the Bad Brains some checks. And, you know, We Will Not is recast as fuck you. We won't do what you told me. I mean, that, okay. But I didn't like it. But I finally realized that in the same way that when that Klaus Kinski released his autobiography, everybody said they were going to sue the fuck out of him if he released it and the publishing company. The publishing company goes, okay. They buckle before it goes to court. They eviscerate the book, eviscerate it. I mean, he was admitting the crimes in the book, so it's just as well. He eviscerated the book and then released it as Kinski Uncut. So when Rage Against the Machine, you know, comes out, and they're raging against the machine, the first thing I thought was, what machine are they raging against? What, the ATM? And then somebody goes, oh, you like them? I go, who? The RATA? I go, they're sending you messages. It's right in front of your face. This is the takeover of corporate rock, and that's why I hated it. Mm-hmm.
You're way off base on Rage Against the Machine.
I liked Rage Against the Machine. I didn't put that in the category, but
they've held up. They're very well regarded by younger kids, and that's you can go by.
Okay.
I mean,
same conversation I had about Fugazi versus Motley Crue is one I'm willing to have about Limp Bizkit versus Rage Against the Machine. I think Limp Bizkit is a much more honest band than Rage Against the Machine.
So you're saying that Motley Crue is a more honest band than Fugazi?
Easy. Any day of the week.
That's fair enough, but it has nothing to do with it. But let me make one point, though, a bigger point.
No, that was a pretty major point.
That's a good argument. But none of this crap is relevant to what I'm trying to do with the series. I don't give a shit about personal taste. I don't care about personal taste.
I know,
but that's just to get your perspectives and to get sort of lance that boil, because I know any group of dudes in their 50s and 40s, like Lexi here, the youngster, is going to hate nu metal. It's just a given. But it's like getting a bunch of Robert Christgau generation guys and then expecting them to have an intelligent conversation about Black Sabbath and Led Zeppelin. Never going to happen in a million years. There was this generational shift of people who were like, loved Dylan, loved the Stones, loved James Brown, loved Cream, and loved Hendrix. But then Led Zeppelin and Black Sabbath came along and they did not get it. They did not like it. They could tell you for the next 40 years why it was terrible. And time, I think, has proven them wrong, because generation after generation, the next musicians came up and said, you know who the greatest band on earth is? Black Sabbath, Led Zeppelin, Black Sabbath, Led Zeppelin. And from, I've been, you know, I'm just, what I'm trying to do with this series, because to me, musicians are hypnotists. And most of the conversations about musicians or music or music histories, well, what hypnotist should I stand in front of and let them enthrall me? I'm trying to stand on the side and just try to get some objectivity, which is very difficult because it's a subjective experience, but I'm trying to get some objectivity, stand on the side and watch the hypnotist work the crowd and trying to look at this stuff in objective stuff. And the only metrics you can get is how popular were they? How big a cultural impact did they have? How much did people write about them, et cetera, how often were they covered? How influential were they on next wave of bands? And then also the story. And this is the thing where I especially hated Limp Bizkit. I mean, they just reeked of, God, this is the worst crap and this is awful. And Woodstock 99 was patently a disaster. But like Ted Joy is one of my favorite music writers, although I violently disagree with him about a lot of stuff.
Who is?
But Ted Gioia is a jazz writer. Mm-hmm. But he had a book called Music, A Subversive History, where he basically charted the whole history of music from the beginning of humanity and talked about how there's this dichotomy or this inevitable battle between music when it's originally made and then music when it's contained and the academy takes it over. Music, you know, gets wild and free and dangerous, and then the academy takes it over and makes it safe again. And one of the things that he flagged as, you can tell when a genre has something going on because there's a lot of death and violence involved, because music's innately dangerous. And when people are messing with this power, and it's magic, it affects human emotions in a way that musicians know. I mean, a really good musician, like listen to Pantera in this episode, they're talking about how we made the crowd respond with our riffs. It's, you know, so certain musicians know what they're doing more than others do. Some of them are just doing it intuitively, and some of them are pretty analytical about it. But they're manipulating people.
It's eerie you should bring this up. I just spent a major segment of the Show Stomper talking about the three different ways of dealing with crowd violence as exhibited by Black Flag, Fugazi, and Oxbow. You know, it's almost like, yeah, it's eerie that you should bring it up. So
when I watched this one after reading Subversive History, Music of Subversive History, and talking to Ted Gioia about it, when I watched Fred Durst in this episode, I realized this kid was playing with powerful forces, and he was doing something that had been done successfully in the past that he did not pull off, which was he was trying to incorporate black arts into white society. He was trying to do what Elvis had done or what Bing Crosby had done, you know, where you take what the black folks are doing and you make it, you just do it because you're a white guy and it makes it more palatable.
I thought you were talking about something satanic, the black art. So I was like, oh, fuck the black. Oh, it is black people, shit.
Yeah. But I mean, there is something satanic about it, this stuff. Well, yeah. I mean, the history of voodoo, et cetera, et cetera. You know,
Haiti. That's right. They sold their soul to Haiti, the devil in order to free themselves from France.
But I mean, it's the. That's an interesting twist.
Never heard that one.
But yeah, of course I started it. I mean, you know, I was one of the first racial scientists to discover that one.
Yeah, no, cool.
but there are these forces that and religious stuff, and to me Woodstock 99 shows that Durst was playing with something powerful, and he was trying to absorb hip-hop into rock and roll, which failed. Rock and roll kind of became a dead genre. You know, it's still sort of sputtering along, but right at the same time Eminem is doing the same thing but on the hip-hop side of things, and he didn't, I guess he succeeded more so than Fred Durst did.
Easily,
yeah, you know, and
it lasted longer, at least.
Yeah, he didn't really. You still see disproportionately fewer white rappers than you would expect to see just because of the number of white people in America, blah, blah, blah. But anyway, I just came around to thinking, wow, Fred Durst was messing with something. He was onto something. And it's not my place to say if Fred Durst's music was any good. I wasn't listening closely. I wasn't a kid. I couldn't, you know, I didn't have any stakes. I didn't have anything on the table. I wasn't betting. I didn't care. You know, I wasn't into pop music anymore, so I could only look at it.
You were listening to Kid Rock, and you just didn't want to be bothered.
And that's another glaring absence from this episode, is Kid Rock really was part of this dynamic, and so was Insane Cloud Posse. But now that we've spent 15 minutes on assortment, let's try to do the history and what the episode does. And the episode starts with Anthrax and Scott Ian. And ultimately, I kind of decided that Dunn is barking up the wrong tree here, completely, but I do think he's covering stuff that needs to be covered. But he's trying to describe new metal as an attempt to merge hip-hop and metal, and I think it's a lot more complicated than that. But if you're going to talk about the merger of hip-hop and metal, obviously Anthrax and Public Enemy Bring the Noise is a logical place to start. He leaves out the Anthrax I'm the Man single that came out in 87, which was them rapping, although with a band backing and kind of tongue in cheek. It was more like the Fat Boys or even a Sugar Hill Gang sort of parody. People couldn't even tell, like, are they just making fun of rap? Are they actually into this? But they were New Yorkers.
Sick of it all with KRS-One.
Yeah, well, that was a more of a collaboration, the way that Anthrax, you know, mm-hmm. when once Anthrax and Public Enemy are obviously collaborating, then it's clear that, you know, they were down. And this was one of those things, like, I was a big hip-hop fan, I was a punk fan, kind of a metal fan, but this merger stuff, this is something I wanted to see, because I knew enough about musical history to think, oh, wow, you know, this is when stuff really gets exciting, is when these different genres merge. And for me, from the minute Bring the Noise came out, this combined version, that whole road just seemed like a disastrous, you know, like I did not care for the Anthrax PE thing. I loved PE. I kind of liked Anthrax. I love Stormtroopers of Death. I like Scott Ian. I just didn't like the singers in Anthrax. But, you know, my personal taste was, I don't think this kind of worked. And then
Biohazard and Onyx.
Right.
Yeah. Same guy made the videos, Drew Stone, who used to be in that hardcore band Antidote. So there was a lot of crossover that wasn't painfully obvious. And I always felt that the Anthrax PE thing to be painfully obvious, you know, not like, what do you mean obvious? Nobody thought of it before. It was just,
and it wasn't even a new song. That was another thing. If they had if they had collaborated on something new, instead of doing sort of a recreation of a PE track with a band playing it instead of the Bomb Squad, you know,
which historically was an issue that hip hop music was dealing with, which is, I don't need a band, I just need a DJ. And so you go for years of like, I don't need a band, I need a DJ, I need a boombox, to like, oh, we have a band now. Oh, we're legitimate. You know, so that's
That is, but at the same time, I mean, Run DMC added guitars really early on. I mean, Rick, to me, this history would really start with Rick Rubin and Run DMC and bringing Kerry King in to play on Public Enemy on their first album, you know, and second album. And, you know, she watched Channel Zero and stuff. Public Enemy had already been doing this stuff. And I saw Schooly D with a rock band open up for Fishbone in 89.
He also borrowed from Cashmere heavily, right?
He did Signify and Signify and Pimp, or I can't remember the name of that. What he called the track? It was a classic track, but he just rapped over a version of Cashmere. But anyway, so they start with that, then they go to Faith No More, which at the time didn't strike me as metal at all. I mean, they had the metal guitar player there, but you know, they had the guy doing the bad rap, and then a keyboard player. I know your friends with Mike Patton, and I actually listened to. And, you know, they were one of those rare groups that had a singer, does two albums, then replaces the singer and has a whole another run, kind of like
two singers or whatever. People don't remember. Actually, Courtney Love sang with them for 2 seconds. And then there was another woman. And then there was Chuck, who just died. And then there was Mike Patton.
Yeah. But they put out two albums with Chuck, or an album and a half with Chuck. Yeah. But then they have this massive MTV hit. And that, like, I think I had checked out their first EP, wasn't all that impressed, and then didn't even get to check out their, I guess, second album before that song was on MTV nonstop, at a point when I was watching MTV all the time. And I didn't mind the song, but I didn't like it enough. I wasn't going to go buy the album. I was hearing plenty of it.
But do you remember, they immediately after that is when they went on tour with Metallica.
Yeah, but Metallica was moving away from metal at that point, you know, and I thought Having Faith No More was one of the tells that they were moving away from that, because that was right around the time Monsters of Rock was going on, you know, here's the thrash scene, and here's Metallica moving on, you know, it was interesting to listen to the Faith No More album. I went back and listened to it, and you know, I kind of enjoyed it. Like to listen to it more, and it does seem like they were massively influential on this next wave of bands. But it also brings us back to something that I keep harping on, which was this whole alternative metal scene that they skipped over entirely, with Jane's Addiction, Fishbone, Living Color, Red Hot Chili Peppers. They told the story as if grunge just came along and slew the dragon, when actually there had been this whole sort of semi-diffuse movement, but this funk punk metal thing was a big part of that. And Faith No More was just one of those bands. And it's fine to me to use one band to stand in for a whole scene. And You know, but Jane's addiction with the Lollapalooza tour in particular was especially massive and important. And if they hadn't broken up when they did, I mean, they were primed to be Nirvana. There had been a number of bands that had been in that spot, and Jane's Addiction kind of was yet another one to abdicate. And and to me, this whole scene is just a big void where the Bad Brains shoulda, coulda, woulda been. I mean, this was the Bad Brains could have ruled the world if they had signed with Elektra in 83. I don't know if that was the right move for them or not, but you know, had things gone differently, if they'd gone on tour with you too in 86, you know, and so
that's the most depressing chapter of hardcore music to me. You know, it's like, it's a pretty major one. Was it? I always wanted to do a movie called The Losers, and they had one last chance and they blew it again and again. It's like, you know, the Madonna tour,
that's the whole history of punk rock, though. From the Velvet Underground to the MC5 to the New York Dolls to the Sex Pistols, that happened over and over and over again. Where, you know, each band, you know, the consensus is people weren't ready for punk rock or people didn't want to hear punk rock. But when you actually look into the details case by case, MC5 were going top 20 and sold 100,000 copies of their first album in a couple of months. Then they get themselves kicked off their record label and make this dramatic change and go new wave in 1970, you know, and nobody wants to hear it. Plus, they've got all this political bullshit going on, you know. New York Dolls, same thing. I mean, they were packing like arenas of 5,000 people in L.A. and Cleveland and Boston and Detroit.
You know, I thought I was a magician, and the Cro-Mags, like I mentioned before, opened up for Motorhead, opened up for AC/DC in Australia, and I know both John Joseph and Harley, and I was talking to them on separate channels about other things completely unrelated. I think I interviewed John for some article I was writing, and Harley, we were talking jiu-jitsu, and I said, you know what, if anybody can put these guys back together, because all I could see was this table with huge amounts of money on it. I just couldn't. And and I ran into John Joseph at some industry, not even the same industry, is this corporate confab in Jackson Hole, Wyoming, of all places. And they were sitting there. I just come out of the sauna, had a terry cloth robe on. And I was like, you guys, you gotta fucking squash this shit. You gotta get back. Gotta get Paris Mayhew. You guys, is Doug Holland. You could do 3 months. You could just make. And he's like, I will never, ever, ever share a same physical space with Harley again. I was like, it just makes no sense. It just, see, an opportunist like me, I just, it makes no sense. Seriously, you don't know how much I would swear. If somebody was offering the kind of money they were offering to Cro-Mags, Whipping Boy,
Eugene, all you have to do, squash the beef, you, Kiedis, Flea. That's what you gotta do.
Bring them back together. Get them back together.
That's the three of you, baby. See?
Okay, what about forget Kiedis, but Eugene replaces him?
Well, but you remember Darren Peligro replaced, who was a drummer that he replaced?
Jack Irons? He replaced the guy before Jack Irons?
Yeah, I think the guy before Jack Irons, and he didn't last that long. But I don't think it was because he had too much LA, I think is what happened.
That can happen. But back to trying to summarize this. And so then they talk about Faith No More, then they go to Rage Against the Machine. And I get your knocks against Rage Against the Machine, but and they were after I had stopped following, right exactly as I stopped following new stuff. They just
found kind of gutless to me, that's all.
But I mean, they made a big impact, and a lot of the kids of that generation were passionate about him. Yeah, and I think they were good. And Tom Morello, I think, was a genius. I mean, the stuff he was doing on guitar to imitate a turntable, I thought was, you know, I didn't pay any attention to it at the time, but going back and looking at what he's doing, that was pretty cool stuff. It wasn't.
Yeah, Eugene, that was cool stuff.
But, yeah, the way he managed to rob all that money and just back the truck up and then get them to ship.
Aren't you complaining about how people leave money on the table? The guy finally opens up the Brinks truck and now you have a beef.
I don't have
to. But if you want to spoil Rage Against the Machine for yourself, There's a couple songs, if you listen to them, where Cake stole, remember Cake? She's Going the Distance. Sacramento. They stole the whole cadence from some Rage Against the Machine songs, and you cannot unhear Cake when you're listening to Rage Against the Machine, and it's just, you know, but be that as may, you know, I think Rage is a key band to be talking about in this, and Pantera is the other one I think that fits in this spot.
I thought that was a strange put, but I was happy to see them in there.
For a couple of reasons.
One is Anselmo can actually really sing, which is enjoyable for me. And he sings from like I talked to the guy Shannon Wright from the Cows, and I said, we were just talking about some project we're going to do, and he said, you know what I grew up listening to? And he grew up listening to all this like really weird Detroit R&B like shit that like what? And you could, it sort of makes sense when you kind of hear his voice. So Pantera, same. Anselmo was listening to some stuff that I just like barely exists on the edge of my consciousness, but it plays through his voice, you know. And then plus his commentary to Rollins will live on in my mind as the greatest thing anybody ever said about Rollins.
Except it's totally covering up the truth, which is he did steal his whole look from not just Rollins, but also Ian MacKaye and the dude from Negative Approach, and that whole beefy.
He just shaved his head. Did he?
He swiped the whole hardcore singer ambiance, but it was a smart move. And I mean, yeah. Pantera's one of the few bands that was. They came around at a time, and I'm from Texas. I know these guys. I dig these guys. I've seen them all throughout their career. They were at a time when you generally had to either be thrash or glam. And they were kind of walking that line between the two. And then they realized at a time when most of their peers did not, that they had to get off this ship. And they updated their sound, and they updated their look. They swiped Helmet's whole thing, and I know you don't want to hear that, Eugene, but it's documented. I mean, the riff from Unsung is swiped by Pantera. Dimebag Darrell fessed up to it. I saw them at Helmet show. Yes, he did. I saw them at the Helmet show in Dallas when that happened, around that time when Helmet came through. Because I followed Helmet throughout their whole Texas tour, and Pantera was at their show. I mean, and that style of riffing became one of the key linchpins of 90s metal, and Pantera were the ones who popularized it. And looking back, I see why Pantera succeeded where Helmet didn't. They had a persona, they had a story, they had better songs, but Helmet did invent that particular style of locking in the bass and guitar.
Did you see that? Somebody had an online quiz and they had 20 titles. I go, are these things a cop would say? Are these Pantera lyrics?
Very close. Walk very on close. Home.
Oh, well, that's a lyric.
But and I did like the guy Terry Date, the producer, who called him Texas Swing Meets Thrash, and I appreciated that because Texas music has always had a little bit more swing. Whether it's country or metal, our music's a little bit more rhythmically complicated because we're more of an ethnic mix than a lot of other places. But then they don't even go into the Dimebag Darrell death and the nasty, nasty feuding that they fell into and everything. It's because they're just using Pantera as sort of a point. Pantera's not the center of the story. They're just pointing to where the story's going to go.
Yeah, but, you know, I wish he would have his distaste would have kind of stepped aside for him to, because like
Dunn,
why do I
him
why yeah. yeah Sam Dunn, like why do I feel okay about Korn but I don't feel as okay about Limp Bizkit, and why do I feel not okay about the Deftones even though I feel like I should feel like okay about the Deftones? I mean, there's a lot
now
of
you're
mixed
talking about your taste in him.
Yeah, exactly. There's a lot of mixed emotion. There's a lot of mixed emotion this music, you know. I mean, and keep in mind, I played a show with Chino, and his whole family's backstage, and they're super nice people. He's a really nice guy, but there was something irredeemably kind of LA about him, and I just was not. It's when he played with what was the name? Narrows, the guys from Palms, the guys from Isis had a follow-on band. They invited me to the show, and a really nice guy. So I'm really this whole new, like, I'm really conflicted about nu metal. Like, I don't have any patience at all for say Linkin Park. Like, I know the dude is dead and whatever, but I just don't. It just seems like corporate surrender. I just can't. But like, I feel okay about Korn. In a way, I feel if you had ran into a room with a gun, say, Eugene, Korn or Nine Inch Nails. I feel more okay about Korn than I feel about Nine Inch Nails. Mm. You know.
Well, yeah, I mean, that makes sense. But I think you're onto something with bringing in Nine Inch Nails and Ministry and White Zombie. Because Korn, to me, is more about bringing in the industrial and the hardcore punk metal bands than it is about the hip-hop or the funk influence. I think that's part of what they were doing.
Mm.
But the vocals are clearly way influenced by Nine Inch Nails, and that whole I'm a trauma patient telling my story of child abuse and stuff, that's very industrial. That whole line of thing is hardcore and industrial, much more so than hip hop. And I feel like Korn doesn't morph into Slipknot, but Slipknot comes along and I think is kind of building on a lot of what Korn did. And I don't have any opinion about Slipknot beyond, whoa, that's freaky and weird, and haven't listened to it, but I'm curious about it. And it seems like the younger metalheads that I respect seem to like Slipknot pretty well.
But I feel Korn okay is about, universally again, liked. But this is the thing. I feel okay about Slipknot, but then I look across the room at the... just fast out of my head. Never mind.
System of a Down.
Yes, part. System of a Down. System Thank of a you. Down. I don't You're feel welcome. Okay about cool. Move Down at all.
I don't have any opinion on those. And again, I don't think our opinions on these are particularly interesting or important. I'm just trying to, what are the trends here and what do we see? You know, and like, what can we see perspective? Alexi's giving me the gas face on that one. But like, I
think for
think
a lot hard. Of that, I think for some of that new metal stuff, not the Korn so much, but Linkin Park, it's when you say it's a corporate takeover, it's because it's polished, low talent rapping, high studio, clean quality, sounding like a movie soundtrack or a TV angsty soap opera soundtrack, as opposed to it's missing. It goes back to the issue that I had with certain grunge groups as opposed to others. If it's not gritty, I mean, Eugene, you said heroin based in terms of the acts that I was talking about, the ones that I like. If it's too clean cut and doesn't have enough of the blues and doesn't have just a certain kind of raw, rough, masculine energy behind, if it's too whiny and too clean and I hate my parents and all it just sounds too suburban, what do you call it, mallcore, right? It sounds Hot Topic kind of music as opposed to something that you walk down the street and you turn down the wrong corner, you're like, what the fuck neighborhood am I in? Like if I feel too safe in the neighborhood, then it's, you know, and I but feel even, like I can beat everybody up, then it's not a place.
But that's not violating the rule to me, because even if we'd say we don't have any opinion about any of this, we're just kind of looking at what happened from the best we can see at third party from, the, you know, 20 years later, Linkin Park is clearly the end of this genre. And it's clear, it's sort of like the Creed of this genre or something. I mean, it's clearly been polished, been digested. Open. Yeah. Even without having an opinion about the quality of their music, it's clear that they are the cleaned up.
I like Arms Wide Open
version of it. I don't know any of their material. I was mildly fascinated with the misspelling of Lincoln, but that was about it. But we'll come back and we'll talk about Deftones and et cetera. But last two things I want to say, Korn from Sacramento, no, from Bakersfield, Deftones from Sacramento. So this is coming from Central California, which is an area of the country that's been kind of underrepped in music, other than the Bakersfield country scene of Merle Haggard and Buck Owens in the 60s. So kind of interesting there. Pantera was from Texas. Where was Faith No More from?
San Francisco.
They were from San Francisco. Okay. So, and then Rage Against the Machine was from LA. So definitely California Center of Gravity, this stuff. And well, we'll continue.
Was it Morello from Boston? He's a Boston guy, wasn't he? Initially. I mean, he met those guys. Yeah. Some of those guys met at Harvard.
And there, and there's the authenticity points just took a big hit. Eugene gets the dagger.
Thank you.
We'll continue this discussion next time.
And now, a word from our sponsors.
E.T.
And we're back, continuing our discussion of new metal. Now, last time we got distracted with some foolishness, and I don't think we covered downtuning and turntables, which are the two instrumental distinctions of the new metal genre. Downtuning, which grunge downtuned to D. Now, normal guitars in E, tune down a step, you've got D, you've got Soundgarden, Nirvana, etc. New metal took it several steps forward, further, added string, got seventh string guitars, eight string guitars, five string basses, tuned down to C, B, sometimes A. So gave what...
Does it just feel like the segment is really long, or is it really long?
You know, when you were talking about tuning the guitars and adding it, I just, in my mind, I kept on hearing the riffs from... Thin Lizzy, the boys are back in town. Because, like, well, they added two guitars.
they had the twin guitars in harmony, but not detuned. Those were regular, you know. The detuning is what the producer did called that it moves something in your guts and it, you know, come across those subsonic frequencies. And then turntable. We know old people don't like new music played by younger people. So we've established that. And I also want to revisit your Rage Against the Machine thing. Like when because that's exactly why rock criticism doesn't work. If you mail out free copies of stuff to people back when content was physical, and they listen to it once or twice and don't care about it either way, it's you might as well just flip coins. I mean, very few rock critics are any good at actually putting in the time to listen. But what it really takes is spending your own hard-earned money and listening to the thing a lot. And then that's when the consensus develops from people who've actually listened to this stuff. So it's no shame on you for missing the boat on Rage Against the Machine, which you clearly did.
No, I listened to both them and Cypress Hill. And I just, in Columbia, I think it was a record label and all the stuff, the attendant. And they were just trying to get me to buy something I wasn't buying in regards to Rage Against the Machine. It's not like I was listening to MC5. It's not like I was listening to, you know, these guys weren't revolutionaries, man.
They weren't to me.
I don't know. I mean, they sold millions of albums. They are critically well regarded. And I think it was the Rolling Stone Best Albums of the 90 poll. They're above your beloved Wu-Tang Clan. So I don't feel like it's our place to decide because I haven't listened to this stuff enough, you know? Like,
you're trying to pull some act of ledger demand here. I don't really consider Rage Against the Machine new metal either. So
no, and I don't think the show is doing that, but they are clearly a precursor of it. They're one of the big funk metal bands. And to me, the reason they're important is because they were the first one to sort of successfully incorporate hip hop elements into the rock setup with rock instrumentation. And that's where your Bad Brains comparison is such a whiff, because everybody was imitating the Bad Brains. I mean, you could say the same thing about Fishbone, Red Hot Chili Peppers, 24/7 Spies, Living Color, Faith No More.
That I would never say
entire genre.
I would never say that about them. Never at all. If you've ever seen the Bad Brains, those comparisons are not apt at all.
Those bands were totally influenced by the Bad Brains. Every single one of those bands was absolutely influenced by the Bad Brains.
A guy who hasn't seen the Bad Brains. Have you seen the Bad Brains?
I never got to see the Bad Brains. I've heard every Bad Brains album. I've heard all of those bands, and they will acknowledge influenced by the Bad Brains.
I was influenced by the Bad Brains. Oxbow sounds nothing like the Bad Brains.
Okay. But bands that do sound like the Bad Brains were influenced by the Bad Brains.
The Red Hot Chili Peppers sound like the Bad Brains?
Elements of it, yeah. They were doing their best.
You should have disappeared now instead of.
Yeah, I mean, it's not about quality, but it's like they were clearly trying to imitate aspects of what the Bad Brains were doing. I mean, that hardcore intensity was what they were trying to bring to it, and also elements, you know, other elements. I mean, the Bad Brains mainly focused on reggae type influences and jazz fusion stuff that you can hear all the way through there. And the Chili Peppers were trying to bring in more of a George Clinton or Gap Band kind of thing into it. But also
known as funk.
Yeah, funk and funk metal. But all those bands, that whole generation of alt metal bands, were totally influenced by the Bad Brains.
I was influenced. Oxbow sounds nothing like, I mean, it doesn't. If you listen to Rage Against the Machine and you take the lyrics, at least to We Will Not, oh, fuck, froze again. Oh, there we go. I'm back. And then you listen to we won't do what you tell us. I mean, you can't tell me. It's like I thought I was listening to We Will Not. It's like he sat down and goes,
I mean, that's a pretty close swipe, but most of their stuff is much more hip hop cadences and rapping. So, I mean, I mean, they were influenced by the Bad Brains. Everybody in their generation was influenced by the best band of the previous generation. That's not news, you know?
Well, I mean, I think what we're talking about is the functioning of the word influenced by, right?
Okay.
That's what we're, right. So I don't know what influenced by means to you. It means like when I hear Stevie Ray Vaughan, I can tell Stevie Ray Vaughan is influenced by Jimi Hendrix. But in my mind, he really sounds nothing like Jimi Hendrix. I could tell he liked Jimi Hendrix, but he doesn't sound like Jimi Hendrix to me, right? But he was influenced by.
I mean, I don't know. His cover of Little Wing was pretty clearly sounding awfully close to Hendrix.
Right? So that's a version of influenced by. Then there's Kingdom Come and their relationship to Led Zeppelin. That's bad influenced by, even though I'm a fan.
I mean, that's just a copy. That's just a ripoff. Right.
What influenced the kids to like new metal, though, Nate?
What?
Rip-off is what I hear when I hear Rage Against the Machine.
What influenced the kids to like new metal?
What made kids like new metal?
Yeah, what influenced them? Yeah, what kind of environment? What's going on at the times?
Well, I mean, the kids who liked it, especially Korn and the early stuff, were totally Trailer Park Kids. Not solely. I was hearing about Korn and Tool from just the punk rock guys I knew, like, you know, these are bands to watch, but there was a ton of bands at that time. But the younger kids that I knew, the ones that really bonded with Korn and, you know, the Juggalos, that's a subset of the people that were influenced, which is different than the people that were into Limp Bizkit when they got really popular. And you can watch, like, going back and watching all of Limp Bizkit's videos in order was really interesting to me, because their first video is very much sort of like a baby Korn. It's set in this sort of rough, scary environment. And the guitarist, Wes Boylan, is doing this sort of proto Marilyn Manson type costume, not at all like what he developed, like the mask persona he developed later. But within two or three videos, Fred Durst has, I think he had the hat backwards the whole time, but they've got a whole brigade of young women with the red hats backwards that are lifting their shirts and flashing and doing the Girls Gone Wild thing. They're having drop-ins from Snoop Dogg and Dr. Dre and Eminem. And I think Weird Al Yankovic or some other weird random celebrity popped in there. I can't remember who it was. It wasn't Weird Al Yankovic. But anyway, it was clear that they became this MTV thing. And they got so big that, you know, by the time they came along, I wasn't playing in bands or going out to shows anymore at all. I still couldn't avoid Limp Bizkit. They became ubiquitous and were screamingly obnoxious. You know, I just hated them without paying any attention to them. You know, I mean, it was clear the guy was just everything that sucked about that era. The whole Girls Gone Wild, frat boy, late 90s, Clinton boom thing, Durst epitomized. But now, going back and looking at this stuff with a little bit more distance and context, and especially, did either of y'all see the Woodstock 99 documentary? Anybody? Anybody?
Years ago.
No.
I mean, it's only been out for like a year or whatever.
Oh, you said the documentary.
Documentary.
Oh, okay. I saw documentaries about Woodstock 99
years ago. Yeah, this is the one Bill Simmons from The Ringer did. Okay. And they, you know, do a basic job, pretty good job of explaining, like, how grossly, I think criminally negligent, I believe. Forgive me if I'm wrong, but I believe that they lost.
Not trying to fame anybody.
Yeah, I'm not trying, but my recollection is they might have lost some lawsuits because the ticket price was enormous. There was no ins and outs. You couldn't bring in your own food and water. The water was, I think, $1 a bottle or maybe $5 a bottle. The toilets didn't work.
Because the fire festival for the fire festival.
Yeah, exactly. And you know, people rioted while Moby was playing, but you're not hearing anybody blaming Moby for this stuff. You know, Fatboy Slim was setting off riots too. And, you know, the documentary totally passes by Rage Against the Machine and every other band that played. And Durst's act definitely escalated the situation. But I feel like he's getting a bit of a bad rap because it's ultimately the promoters that are liable and negligent.
Always.
I mean, yeah, it's their job. They're the ones that are supposed to make sure, you know, people have enough water to drink and safe, clean places to camp and toilets that work. And, you know, four or 5 day festival and the heat, not enough security. Water. Yeah. And security.
Where's the fun in that?
I know. I know. You know, but it is definitely easier to blame Durst. And
but it's weird. It's weird as you go through the names, what offends me and what doesn't offend me. It's like Motley Crue versus Fugazi. Like when I see, hear or talk of Limp Bizkit, I'm not super offended. They are like their generation's Motley Crue. Stupid guys who do stupid things, and I don't expect much from them, and they don't disappoint, right? Mm-hmm. And in that actual fact, I like the rags to riches aspect of Fred Durst's story, and he pretty much does exactly what I would expect him to do in his position, you know, with no promise, get that brass ring and, you know, whatever. It's like, it's a guy, and I like Korn as well, and I saw Tool and Tijuana opening for Rollins, and I said, those guys are great. Yeah, it's a great band. So I don't, but there's certain members of the nu metal community that just kind of rubbed me the wrong way. And fundamentally, I liked Rage Against the Machine's music, but I thought they were really dishonest. I didn't buy a single word that they fucking sang, not a single one, you know? And so I think that they were phonies and the frauds. And I, you know, you could call them whatever you want to call them musically. And I understand, you know, Morello was doing interesting things with his guitar. I also look at Provenance, and then I look at, okay, you couldn't really help the Bad Brains, right? I mean, they displayed themselves.
You couldn't save them from themselves.
You couldn't say them from themselves, absolutely positively. The Beastie Boys tried, Madonna tried. Like, I mean, it's legion of numbers of people who tried to help and just, you know. Later it was revealed, of course, that HR had chemical imbalances and so on, which sort of makes sense. But the reality of it is, I don't know that Rage Against the Machine put anybody on it. And that was always my standard from punk rock in the day. I mean, at least as much as I hate the Chili Peppers. At least they said to Darren at a certain point, Darren Peligro, who used to drum for the Dead Kennedys and now drums for them again, was like, hey, man, pulled him up out of San Francisco for a bit, had him drum. You know, he ended up, that didn't end up working out from what I understand because of LA problems. And make of that what you would, but they tried to like give back to the community. And maybe Rage Against the Machine is doing it in ways that I don't know, you know, but musically, artistically, given the nature of their robbery, they really helped nobody else musically. They might have been part of some scene.
What do you mean, musically? Like, how did they not?
I mean what Korn did with Limp Bizkit, that was nailed.
The direct hand up. Yeah, that's a business yeah, but yeah. But musically, this whole scene, I mean, at least Dunn is arguing that Pantera plus Rage Against the Machine plus Faith No More equals new metal, that all these bands were that those were three of the biggest influences on this whole next generation of metal. And so
I'm just trying to qualify my distaste, and you know, say what you want about Anselmo, though he has been not given, we're not asking for handouts. He's been given hands, you know. Korn, same. It's these guys that are the ladder pullers that I hate, and then I hate their music, you know.
That makes sense, because I was wondering, when you say inauthentic and all this kind of stuff, like what? It was just not resonating with me. But when you're talking about specifically giving back to a community, being part of a community, being, you know, following up and having tremendous commercial success, and I totally get it. I think to a certain degree, like as a listener and a fan, you know, who's not a part of a scene or a part of, you know, who's not a musician, totally not be aware of any of that stuff going on. You just notice the kind of superficial representational things that people say and the communities they're talking about without thinking about the community they're coming from. And I'm not talking about ethnically or racially, which is the kind of thing that drew me to them back community. In the day. Is the music community. So it's kind of a fascinating dynamic. I think it's really fascinating in the sense that like this whole Marxist representation versus, but as musicians, you know, and as someone that actually has commercially exploded, how have you given back? How are you looking out for your brothers? How are you looking out for your people? It's interesting.
Put themselves in an impossible situation, much like the MC5 did, by taking on this explicit advocacy of radical politics, that puts a big target on their back. Everybody sets these impossible standards for them to live up to. I mean, you know, if you're going to be the band that's talking about causes and socialism and against capitalism, that sets a high level of expectations that's really hard to meet. And I haven't followed their career closely enough to have any idea if they helped people out or didn't help people out. I have no idea.
They protested the Democratic Convention, which helped Bush win.
There's just a lot of talk of we and us and us and and then I don't see, you know, and there's another guy who he didn't come up in this segment, but Vernon Reed is another guy. He's friends with my sister and they played music together. But outside of that, that guy hasn't been full of a lot of we and us and we and we. It's usually about him and him and him. And
he founded the Black Rock Coalition and did a ton to advocate for more space for black musicians.
You know who tried to be a member of the Black Rock Coalition and was high-handed? Any black rock musicians you know that on the show? he's gone.
He disappeared. I think that hat. He wasn't wearing a hat. You back scratched him into oblivion.
this is a shepherd's crook that helps with the back pain. But you know, right. There he is.
You know, I don't associate with musicians. Like,
yeah. So there you go. Now you're
nearly.
This is perfect. I think this is perfect. This is perfect for the new metal episode, what's been happening, because it's like, no matter how much you try to write the ship, there's just something there that's just not.
I have a big picture theory, though, as to why new metal gets so much hate.
Why is that?
I totally hated this stuff in the 90s.
311.
Without really paying any attention to it, you know, but that was just my reaction was, boy, funk, you know, like, I always thought that some kind of merger of metal and funk or metal and hip hop was an exciting thing that needed to be pursued. And then as soon as people started pursuing it, I was like, maybe not so much. And by the time, you know, Limp Bizkit was up there with DJ Lethal on the turntable and everything, I was just bowled over by how terrible I thought this was. But in retrospect, and I think that what really happened in new metal was they were the first generation of rock bands that were when rock was no longer the thing. Dr. Dre and Snoop killed rock and roll, or dethroned rock and roll in 1993. They became it. New metal is having to go up against Biggie and Tupac, which is just an epic tale. I mean, you know, like nothing post-Cobain had rock and roll, and to this day, nothing since Cobain has magnetized the whole American culture the way Cobain did and the way rock and roll did before that for decades. And so nu metal's in this impossible situation where they're competing with hip hop. I think in retrospect, they were doing, a lot of these bands were doing, I think there were probably as many talented nu metal bands and musicians as in any other scene, and that they were very open to new ideas in a way that metal had not been in a long time. And that they're, you know, I mean, you look at like Led Zeppelin or Blue Cheer or Black Sabbath or the Stooges, and these were bands that were just, you know, drinking at the fountain. They were into jazz, they were into blues, they were in you know, classical music. They were taking in all these influences from all these sources, particularly African-American sources. And then metal got more and more constrained until people, bands like Poison, you know, how many influences does Poison have? Like six bands that they were just ripping off directly. And you know, and so nu metal is kind of this much needed infusion of fresh ideas and you know, just a real artistic freedom that people hadn't had. But because they were the first generation of rockers to not be kings of the culture, they are always going to feel like phonies to people who remember what rock and roll was like in the 70s and 80s and et cetera, when rock and roll was it, when rock and roll was totally dominant in the culture. I mean, you know,
That's an interesting theory, but they still suck. So
this is like a bunch of old people, you know, people that were Lawrence Welk fans talking about Led Zeppelin. Yeah. We are not qualified to judge this music. You had to have been in that generation and you had to put in the time listening to it. If you were, you know, the stuff we grew up with, like, you know, you in the 70s, me in the 80s, Alexi in the 90s, that we heard in high school, whether we wanted to or not. You know, like I can venture a pretty sound opinion on Quiet Riot because I had to hear that shit hundreds of times without wanting to. You know, I get in a car to get a ride home. Here's Quiet Riot. I get, you know, go to lunch with some friends. Hey, Quiet Riot's on the stereo. You know, I know that Quiet Riot tape back and forwards. There's no way for us, unless we, you know, were the rare people in their 30s that were, you know, really hardcore fans of new music, and I don't know many people that do that. There's no way for us to really opine. I mean, it's also to me, the only way to judge bands is the most important thing is how influential were they on the next generation of bands. So I think that's the most damning thing against glam metal is, like, you notice that none of these bands have any interest in glam metal. And I also find it interesting that these bands are much more influenced by Faith No More, by Living Color, by Jane's Addiction, by Helmet, that whole alt metal movement really didn't get big shine, clearly set the tone for the future much more than thrash metal did. Like thrash metal leads to death metal, which kind of went nowhere. I mean, you know, I enjoyed death metal. I preferred black metal, but, you know, death metal is something I did put in the time. I don't think it just painted itself into a corner. There's no melodies. There's no, you know, you can't hear what they're singing for the most part. A normal citizen cannot tell.
It's kind of what happened to jazz, right? When they started getting into freaking harmonics and the audience was like, I'm sorry, I got to go, you know? So
to a large extent, except, you know, if you read about Ornette Coleman's bands, he was packing them in. I mean, when it was original Ornette Coleman.
I'm thinking less about him and more about who is that cat who just played the small, venue in San Jose, and all these people came thinking that they were going to get smooth sounds of jazz, and his name in a second, and he comes out, he's, you know, older black cat with a sax, and he starts to play, and you know, it was skronk to the, it just, they couldn't, after about 40 minutes they just broke the audience, people start filing out.
But God, the other thing though about free jazz, and you're kind of repeating the old Stanley Crouch, Wynton Marsalis, that stuff didn't mean anything, it didn't go anywhere, it didn't
influence anybody. I'm a fan
but I know you are, and I am too, but It also influenced Cream, Jimi Hendrix, the Stooges, MC5. All of those bands would never have raged and improvised as wildly as they did without Ornette Coleman, all of whom listened to Ornette Coleman a lot. So this idea that free jazz, I mean, I think bop is more where jazz kind of became an art music, and there's virtues to that, but it no longer was popular music.
I'm talking about pop versus not pop, you know, people packed out to see.
Yeah. And that was really good. That was Charlie Parker and Dizzy Gillespie, who sort of made a conscious choice. We're going to make this art music because we're into what we're doing.
Yeah. If you listen to some of the live Thelonious Monk stuff, and I mean, even with an expectation that the producer probably sweetened it between takes, it's like, it's clearly, I could tell crowd sounds. It's clearly fewer than 30 people listening. So I guess.
You know, he was also way ahead of his time, but we're on a schedule here. We've already gone afield. And so, you know, the show lays out the influences of nu metal, like Pantera and Rage Against the Machine, partly because I don't think they knew where to put them exactly. I think Pantera is still a really hard band to pigeonhole because they just became Pantera. And for a while, they were basically the metal band that was out there. Like, you know, in the early 90s, they were the biggest, most intense metal band going. And they were just kind of, they were heavy metal there for a bit. And I think that I really think this series, just like with Hip Hop Evolution, could have used a whole episode on the Slick Rick era, that, you know, post Afrika Bambaataa, pre Run DMC era. This series could really have used an alt metal or funk metal episode. Mm-hmm. I just think people like Jane's Addiction and Living Color, et cetera, you know, deserve the shine. So they pigeonhole two bands out of that, Rage Against the Machine and Faith No More, into this episode. They talk about Korn, which everybody agrees Korn invented nu metal. Korn is the definitive nu metal thing. They don't talk about, to me, like, the thing about Jonathan Davis is, to me, and I haven't listened to him closely, but I've heard a bit of it, that it's not as hip hop influenced as it is industrial influenced. That his vocal influences with the whispering and all that stuff is coming more from Nine Inch Nails and Ministry and that whole thing, which again, you could have a whole episode on Ministry, Nine Inch Nails, White Zombie, and Marilyn Manson. And they're going to talk about Marilyn Manson next time in the Shock Rock episode. And they're going to put Slipknot in there too. Slipknot, I think, would more rightly belong in a nu metal episode. And so then they talk about the Deftones, who were initially associated with nu metal, but who consciously disassociated themselves from nu metal. They refused to tour with these guys. And, you know, the Deftones is one, from talking to people that are younger than us, are really highly respected and seem to be only getting more highly respected. And what surprised me was they were way into shoegaze. Like My Bloody Valentine. Mm-hmm. Like when I listen to them, I'm hearing tons of My Bloody Valentine and that kind of stuff. And that's what I've been impressed by going through and listening to playlists and skimming through the nu metal stuff, is they were throwing the kitchen sink at it. There's all kinds of stuff that was open to it. And it's different than glam metal, which is this totally constipated, strictly regulated set of things you could do and not do.
When I met Chino, he was singing for Palms. And Palms was a group that he sort of initiated with the guys with at least 2/3 of the members of ISIS, who were clearly, you know, that kind of very stately neurosis, like, you know, I wouldn't call it shoegaze metal, but, you know, 13-minute songs. And so he initiated this, wanted to sing for something like that. And I do not see Fred Durst doing that in a million years. So
no, Fred Durst is a much more limited thing. But again, I think Fred Durst came the closest to overthrowing hip hop. If he had come along in a different era, like, you know, like when Elvis Presley came along, a couple years before Elvis Presley, no black artists could get on the air or the radio at all. You had people like Georgia Gibbs just hearing a Laverne Baker song or a Ruth Brown song. I don't even think it was Georgia Gibbs making these decisions, but the producers would just be, let's do that song with Georgia Gibbs and we'll take it to number one. Sorry, Eddie.
Come on.
You know,
Pat Boone's Tutti Frutti. That was
exactly.
That was definitive. definitive.
It was definitive. It was the definitive Pat Boone version, you know. And so when Elvis came along, he opened a lot of doors. Little Richard credited Elvis, was like, he's the reason I got to be on TV, you know, because he was so shocking and everything else. But Elvis didn't have to go toe-to-toe with Jackie Wilson. He had this enormous advantage just because he was white and was going to get that kind of media attention. By the time Fred Durst came along, he didn't have that big advantage, but still became so big. And I think was incorporating hip-hop. I think he was native to hip-hop. I think he grew up on hip-hop and he did it reasonably well.
Which is what he says.
Yeah. And I think Wes Borland, I was amazed at that guy. That guy's a really good guitar player. And he was doing all kinds of cool stuff that from, you know, Sonic Youth and Fugazi. I mean, I was hearing stuff like from all over the place. My Bloody Valentine, all kinds of stuff. The guy has his ears wide open. And, you know, it's like, you remember when Stone Roses and Happy Mondays came along? And it didn't have quite the same impact in the States. But in England, electronic music, dance music had taken over the country, and the Stone Roses and Happy Mondays were this sort of like attempt by rock musicians to incorporate that. And it was kind of like a war of the genres. Is EDM going to be the thing, or is rock going to absorb EDM into it? Cause that's what rock did to folk. That's what rock did to jazz. I mean, rock had absorbed all these genres, you know, and had been this omnivorous monster that just gobbled up everything until hip hop came along. And hip hop overthrew it. And Durst is kind of this attempt by rock to steal that back. And I think that's playing with powerful forces. And I think that's why he's sort of this cursed figure in culture and hated so much. And if you look at their career path, you know, they got so big and then dived off. I mean, fell off a table, you know, and it wasn't after Woodstock 99 that their next album was bigger than ever. It was, you know, they probably put out a really bad album. That's, you know, whenever I see a band
also let's not forget the TMZ effect. Like Durst was appearing in lots of non-musical venues, just assing it up, you know. So
yeah, he wore out his welcome in multiple.
And he
ways.
Was a record executive too.
He was he?
Yes, he was. They gave him a nice. They gave him a nice big job at the label really soon after he blew up. So. That's something that's always amazed me in terms of getting the keys to the kingdom so early on in your career. But
No more bad tattooing.
Yeah, that was a funny story about how he met Korn, gave him a tape, gave him a free tattoo that spelled horn instead of corn. Yeah. And we didn't even talk about Linkin Park, which I knew nothing about other than that I had heard the name. I'd seen the video and thought they were torpy looking kids, but watching more videos and reading more about them, these guys had a long run at the top. They were enormously successful. They sold more albums than the Eagles. They sold 70 million albums. And they came along at a point when the music industry was selling more CDs than it ever did before and it ever would again. So, you know, it's not apples to apples, but still, they did that. They also produced a lot of their own stuff. They directed their own videos. They did their own graphic design. Like, I mean, there's a whole lot more to Linkin Park than I thought. I was totally floored by that. And subsequent generations of musicians, it seems like they are the band out of this coterie that influenced the future the most. So I'm totally reassessing what, I mean, I hadn't put any thought into Linkin Park before this, but I'm like, wow, these guys check off every box to me of what is a significant or important band. And personal taste is not what this is about. I don't give a shit about my personal taste on this stuff. And I definitely don't care about you guys' personal taste on this stuff. To me, there's objective metrics you can look at. Album sales isn't definitive because tons of shitty bands that don't have any future impact sell a lot of records. But bands that have a long sustained career, that have a big hand in their own career like that, that control their own stuff and then influence the future that way. What's so funny?
You don't know how much of a travail, how much of a trial this new metal segment has been for me. I'll be so glad to get it a shot. I don't think any other segment in this series has been as
trying. And why? Why is it so trying?
Because I feel it to be of little merit. You can say all you want about fucking record sales and about influences, and it doesn't look, you know, I really like Leroy Neiman as a guy. I would never have a Leroy Neiman painting in my house, right?
Well, it's a matter of personal like a nice taste.
And there you go. So there's your answer to why.
And timing.
But again, I mean, this series shouldn't be about personal taste. We're not like most musical stuff. To me, musicians are hypnotists, right? They're magicians. Mm-hmm. They're trying to compel your attention, take your emotions somewhere. And most music discussion is about which hypnotist should we sit in front of and be wowed by, you know, and how should we worship this amazing magician? I'm trying to stand to the side and be where I can see the tricks in the back and see the crowd response and see which guys are good musicians, not which is my favorite. That's what I'm trying to do. So, I mean, hell, I did an episode on, what's that terrible poet? The worst poet of all time. That was also the best-selling poet of all time. Rod McEwen. Did a whole episode on Rod McEwen. If you think nu metal is difficult, and you didn't even do any homework, it's not like you've been sitting here listening to nu metal playlists for the last 2 weeks like I have. I mean, like, I've had this crap in my head.
You could tell.
Yeah, I mean.
That's on you.
Yeah, well, that's, you know, what I'm doing.
And that's glad you did that, Nate. Thank you. Yes, as we put an end to this chapter of
of metal, and we'll be back next time to talk about shock rock.
Follow the Let It Roll podcast on Twitter at Let It Rollcast, and check out our website at letitrollpodcast.com. You might be surprised to hear that Eugene has subsequently revised his take on nu metal and thanks Nate for changing his mind. More on that in future episodes. Next week, Nate, Eugene, and Alexi return to discuss shock rock, including Marilyn Manson, Slipknot, and more. Let It Roll is a Pantheon podcast, and you can listen to more great podcasts at www.pantheonpodcasts.com.